California Public Radio presents Vietnam Reconsidered, Lessons from a War. On February 6th through 9th, 1983, 10 years after the signing of the Paris Peace Accords, the University of Southern California hosted a conference re-examining the Vietnam War. For 4 days, over 80 panelists and 1,000 participants reviewed and sometimes replayed the war in Vietnam. In this series of programs, California Public Radio will bring you the views of correspondents, former government officials, and scholars, as well as the voices of Vietnamese refugees and Vietnam veterans, as they reconsider the war that transformed them and their countries, as they reconsider Vietnam. Part 3, The War at Home.
Weapons do not make peace. Men make peace, and peace comes not through strength alone, but through wisdom and patience and restraint.
To President Lyndon Johnson, conflicting information about past North Vietnamese offers to negotiate have raised doubts about U.S. policy. Participants in March on Washington for Peace in Vietnam respectfully urge full disclosure of these offers and administration responses.
Yesterday, State Secretary Rusk said if the demonstrators would write to both Hanoi and Washington, they would find...
Let go of the flag, please.
...willingness on the American side for unconditional negotiations, but not the same from Hanoi. What's your comment?
Well, Johnson says he's for unconditional negotiations, but he will not negotiate with the National Liberation Front. This is not a negotiating position. This is an excuse. This is a phony lie. If he wants to negotiate, let him sit down with the people he's fighting against.
The question stirred you the most about this.
Well, I don't know these young kids with these long haircuts and the people, their appearance in general.
This is Martin Luther King.
I am here as a Negro. I know what bombings do for an oppressed people. For I have seen oppressed people respond to bombing and violence across the South. And I would say to the experts who are determining our military strategy that bombings only make an oppressed people more determined to throw off any yoke of oppression.
It is true that a house divided against itself is a house that cannot stand. There is division in the American house now. And believing this, as I do, I have concluded that I should not permit the presidency to become involved in the partisan divisions that are developing in this political year. Accordingly, I shall not seek, and I will not accept, the nomination of my party for another term as your president.
Along with the war Americans watched on their television screens came the war in the streets, as an increasing number of U.S. citizens publicly demonstrated their opposition to the war in Vietnam. Today's program includes speakers from panels discussing the impact of that anti-war movement and the effect of the war on U.S. culture. A challenge had been laid down before these two panels met by John Mueller, a political scientist from the University of Rochester. We begin with a short piece from his presentation.
I once made a study of public opinion, and I was very interested in all public opinion analyses of comparing public opinion data. I think that's the only way to do it sensibly. And I made a study in which I tried to compare the American public opinion toward Vietnam and the American public opinion toward the Korean War, which are very similar in many respects. Well, the result of that was an overall conclusion that, looking at it in various different ways, that basically they were the same. that Vietnam was not the most unpopular war, that Korea was equally unpopular for the period during which the wars were comparable. In other words, during which the casualty rates, after Vietnam had cost more in American casualties than Vietnam, it then became less popular than Korea, but only when it ceased being comparable in that sense. The trends in public support followed basically the same pattern. They were essentially a logarithm of the number of American casualties. The support declined as casualties declined in slightly different patterns, but because of the way that casualties were inflicted differently in the two wars. Furthermore, the same people basically supported the wars. I've been saying this for 17 years now, and other people in political public opinion analysis have, but let me repeat it for the 9 millionth time, that overall the war was supported disproportionately, presidential policy was supported disproportionately during both wars by the young and by the college educated, not the reverse. The one thing that was obviously very different between Vietnam and Korea was that there was this ferocious anti-war movement within the United States, and there's virtually nothing in Korea. Someone wrote a couple letters to the New York Times once, and they said, we ought to get out, perhaps, and so forth. Despite the fact that there was this, that the public opinion basically was the same, and this, I don't, since anti-war movement is being discussed tomorrow, I don't want to tromp on their turf, but would simply say that suggests that the anti-war movement in many respects may have been counterproductive, or if it was productive, it was counterproductive in the sense that particularly in the early years of the war, 65 to 68, it tended to be associated with bomb throwing, Viet Cong flags, burning the American flag, and indeed in the in 1968 a poll was made of the anti-war movement, and they found that they were asked, the American public was asked to place the anti-war movement on a scale from 0 to 100. 33% placed them in the zero category, and only 16% placed them anywhere in the top half of the scale, which you have to, I mean, the American Nazi Party and a few other places get that, but not. At any rate, what I'm saying is the movement was perhaps not as effective as it would have been because it had these negative connotations. I don't mean to say it was completely unproductive. I think it was vital in affecting some political elections, such as the one in 68, by attacking Hubert Humphrey. It essentially assured the election of Richard Nixon. I think that's probably its major achievement.
Todd Gitlin teaches sociology at the University of California's Berkeley campus and is the author of The Whole World is Watching, Mass Media and the Unmaking of the New Left. A former president of Students for a Democratic Society in the early 60s, Gitlin took issue with Professor Mueller.
It's a curious thing already manifest here. Of all the voices proclaiming these days that the movement against the Vietnam War had an enormous impact, the loudest by far seem to be precisely those who denounce the movement and the impact alike. The so-called conservatives, I mean, the neo and paleo varieties, think that the country was seized in the 60s, more or less, by a, quote, new class of leftish intellectuals and students and uppity minorities and women who not only trashed standards and learning and language and the family, but broke the back of national security and leveled America's just position in the world, and in particular, cost us an achievable and noble victory in Vietnam. By conspicuous contrast, I have the impression that most of the one-time anti-war activists of the 60s think that the movement accomplished precious little. And most students today, I have the sense, self-protectively, seem to agree that the far-gone 60s were a riotous bust. I'm going to disagree. I think it is probably truer to say, in fact, that the movement against the Vietnam War was the most successful movement against a shooting war in history. I want first to go back to the years before the more lurid images of 1969 to 72. I mean the NLF flag waving, the window trashing, the rock throwing, the townhouse explosion that killed three members of the Weather Underground, the bombings, the ROTC building torchings, the rocks thrown at Richard Nixon by God knows whom, and so on, all that. We heard Professor Mueller speak yesterday of the bomb throwers of 1965 to 68. I want to say that this is an outrageous Orwellian rewriting of history. The total number of bombs thrown by anti-war activists during those years is zero. Let's go back to 1964-65, when the Johnson administration's commitment to the Vietnam War took hold. Some facts, plain facts. You recall the August-September Tonkin Gulf affair and the carte blanche Senate resolution that followed. In order to set the context from what I'm about to say, let's be reminded that the grand total of dissenting votes in the Senate was two. Wayne Morris, Ernest Greening. At Christmas 1964, Students for a Democratic Society, which was a multi-issue, liberal, radical organization with a few hundred active members, if that, presumptuously called for a national demonstration against the war to take place in April. In the meantime, of course, the Johnson administration began the systematic bombing of North Vietnam. In April, more than 25,000 people marched against the war, the great majority of them, amazingly, dressed up in jackets and ties. No bombs. Later that month came the first campus teach-ins. That fall, the first coordinated demonstrations across the country, some of them more militant, including attempts to stop troop trains. There were widely publicized draft card burnings and a national media hysteria about a non-existent SDS plan to disrupt the draft. Within the next 18 months, some of the civil rights leadership began denouncing the war. There were the first attempts to get anti-war measures on local ballots and to carry the war issue into professional associations and so on. That fall, 1967, came the vast mobilizations in Washington at the Pentagon and in downtown Oakland. In both of these, for the first time, armed troops and riot-equipped police wreaked havoc against active nonviolence. In 1968 came the first murmurs on the part of the anti-war movement, and they were murmurs only, about the need for violence to stop the war because nothing else seemed to work. There were also, no doubt, the first activities by the government's agence provocateur. We don't collectively know nearly enough and are not collectively curious enough about all this, but one little tidbit is at least tantalizing. In August 1968, as you know, a few thousand people went out into the Chicago streets and the media spotlight during the Democratic Convention. According to Army intelligence sources, pried loose by CBS News, to their credit, 10 years later, and I quote, about one demonstrator in six was an undercover agent, close quote. During the great Bloody Wednesday battle that week, which made headlines and impressions all over the world, according to the same sources, in the crowd on Michigan Avenue were 200 government agents. With glacial slowness, fragments of information of this sort seep into the light. But our famous investigational press is notoriously quiet for the most part. In any event, I want to suppose now for a moment that the war had gone on, as was discussed yesterday, without any material public opposition. Suppose there had been passive opposition in the polls, but no movement in the streets. Suppose, in other words, a war more or less like Korea. What would have kept the war from escalating even more intensely and earlier than it actually did, with more ordnance, more troops, more death? What opposition would have been mustered against the military's designs to press the war to the very screaming limits of military technology? Concrete evidence of the movement's effect is, of course, very hard to come by. So much so, in fact, that for the most part, much of the movement itself usually felt it was accomplishing next to nothing. After all, the successive administrations weren't giving any credit away. And so came the movement's desperate cycle of trying to raise the stakes. Double or nothing. More fury, eventually more violence, and especially when the media dutifully played their part as amplifiers of the worst and the dumbest of anti-war theater. Just one specific sign, though, of what I want to call the movement's veto power. David Halberstam tells us in The Best and the Brightest that in late 1966, the military were already urging President Johnson to bomb Hanoi and Haiphong, to block the harbor there, and in Halberstam's words, to take apart the industrial capacity of both cities. Johnson said on one occasion, quote, how long will it take for 500,000 angry Americans to climb that White House wall out there and lynch their president if he does something like that? which ended for a time, Halberstam writes, the plan to bomb Hanoi and Haiphong. So the movement acquired a certain veto power, but had little inkling of it. All it knew was that every day the death went on, which is, in my opinion, why, for the most, the main reason why the movement drove itself toward a bitter-ended and self-isolating militancy, or rather, first toward that militancy, and by 1972, away from activity altogether. The movement's influence, though, directly on the course of events, was mostly indirect. There's no evidence that the movement directly affected public opinion. Public opinion did turn steadily against the war, but if anything, as the war became steadily less popular, so did the movement against it, maybe all the faster. No, the movement made itself felt mostly by the effects it had on the politics and economics surrounding the war. Although as time went on, the movement didn't want to think of itself as, quote, merely reformist. It amounted to a small engine that turned the more potent engines, which could, in fact, retard the war. What happened, of course, is that the political, corporate, and media elites grew disillusioned with the war. It wasn't working. First, in the fall of 1967, the Wall Street Journal dissented from the war on purely practical grounds. A few months later, in the wake of Tet, as we've heard, Walter Cronkite, among others, was saying publicly that the United States ought to find a way out, having failed, as he put it, to defend democracy. Cronkite by then, of course, was far from alone. First the McCarthy, then the Kennedy campaigns drew a great deal of anti-war energy into the political mainstream. And at the same time, Johnson's incoming Secretary of Defense, Clark Clifford, lost faith in the war effort and set out to mobilize influential opposition within the political elite that had represented foreign policy consensus since 1945. And as the Joint Chiefs of Staff, in the wake of Tet, requested 206,000 new troops and Congress debated, Clifford persuaded Johnson to meet with the informal advisory group later known as the Wise Men, Dean Acheson, George Ball, McGeorge Bundy, Douglas Dillon, Cyrus Vance, and others. 3 days later, Johnson refused General Wheeler's troop request, announced the partial bombing halt, and took himself out of the presidential campaign. The Wise Men were wise indeed to see that the war simply cost too much in both political and economic terms. Congress sluggishly learned the same lessons. My point is that the anti-war movement was instrumental to all of this. Politically, the Wise Men were impressed by the threat to social peace at home. Economically, the dollar was sinking fast. The balance of payments had turned negative, and American gold was draining away. The immediate cause, of course, for that was that Johnson dared not increase taxes to finance the war, fearing that the country was queasy enough about the war to smash up his political base if he tried. So to have his war, he had to go deeply into deficit financing. And a lot of economists, of course, believe that this is the beginning of the great inflation of the 70s. So eventually, in all kinds of ways, the anti-war movement, with its political allies, eased the United States out of Vietnam. From the impulse, as Clancy mentioned, came the movement for the liberation of women, the premise that discussions like this conference are healthier than repression, some of the stirrings for participatory democracy, which for all its problems is still alive, a perpetual counter-tradition in some of today's movements. So to say that the movement failed, period, only closes the discussion about what now that should only be opening. And this is the final achievement of the anti-war movement. It battered the unreflective anti-communism of the 50s and made it possible to think about opening new doors, as it now becomes possible to think past the knee-jerk anti-communism of the 60s. Anyway, movements are compost for later movements. I like what William Morris wrote, and I quote, "Men fight and lose the battle. And the thing they fought for comes about in spite of their defeat. And when it comes out not to be what they meant, other men have to fight for what they meant under another name." Thank you.
David Dellinger was one of the Chicago Seven, arrested at the Democratic National Convention in 1968, and a defendant in one of the most widely publicized trials of the century. He, too, takes up the question of the anti-war movement's effect on U.S. policy in Vietnam.
Did the protest movement help shorten the war? That's an important question, but it must not be approached in isolation. It has to be put into the context of the kind of society that would fight that kind of a war has to be put into the context in which the anti-war movement operated. The immediate context was a period still of McCarthyism. There was ugliness in high places. There was also demoralization in the progressive movement, a demoralization not fully caused by, but certainly one of whose major causes was the silence and the apology of the progressive movement for sincere, romantic, idealized reason, silence about the crimes of the Soviet Union. And so the ugliness in high places got further than it would have, and the movement was demoralized. Well, now, the first sign of hope, really, in what had been called a silent generation, a country of apathetic people, was the beginnings of risings amongst blacks in the South, what later became known as the Civil Rights Movement. Of course, there were other things. There was the Ban the Bomb Movement, which contributed, became an important stream going into the anti-Vietnam War movement. Well, on the question of stopping the war, I want to take a hurried look at one action. The so-called Siege of the Pentagon on October 21st and 22nd of 1967. Now, that protest began under two slogans. One was, "From protest to resistance." The other one was, "Shut down the Pentagon." These two slogans caused us to have to deal with a third one, come up with one, because the seriousness of the movement, the fact that it was talking about not leaving behind legal marches, demonstrations, rallies, protests, and it never should leave them behind, but of adding something, a resistance movement. And so there was going to be a two-tiered action, including nonviolent civil disobedience, with enough separation so that those who wanted to come for the march and rally, but not for the civil disobedience, could be separated. So that brought out the first massive deployment of U.S. troops to police and restrict the demonstration. And it became a question of how we would respond to that. And some people spoke in terms somewhat similar to what Todd alluded to in other connections, snarling that they're fascists and they're robots. They're the enemy. And I remember that we were up until about 5 o'clock in the morning. The organizing committee, where people are coming in from all over the country, maybe a couple hundred people, discussing how to respond. And we finally decided that the only proper approach was to say to the troops, "You are our brothers, join us. You are victims too. We support you, we stand in solidarity with you, stand in solidarity with us." And this was very important spiritually, and it was very important tactically. Now, in retrospect, people may not remember, but at that time, nobody knew that the GIs and the returning veterans would become the cutting edge of the anti-war movement. So what we did for proper moral reasons also turned out to be the best tactic. Well, after it was over, within our movement, people who were impatient, as a matter of fact, I'd like to talk to Frank Snepp or one of the CIA people, see if this article came out of the CIA. But anyway, in an important anti-war publication of the period, there was an article saying that the demonstration had failed. It toted up the cost of bringing 200,000 to 250,000 people to Washington, and the fines of those who paid them, although most of us refused, those of us who were arrested. And it said, "The movement has got to grow up. 12 people could have stopped the Pentagon more successfully by burning cars in the driveways, the approaches to the Pentagon." And of course, they missed the whole point of it, because we have to be a movement of people, not a movement with military objectives or mechanical successes. And that action had a profound effect upon the country. It also had a profound effect upon the government. It was followed not very long later by Tet, about which we've heard quite a bit. And after Tet, the Joint Chief of Staffs asked for 206,000 new men to come to Vietnam to swell the ranks. And as always, the promise that in a few months, if they got them, we would have victory. They would have victory. And for the first time, instead of just cutting back a little, sending 200,000 or 170,000, whatever it would be, they sent none. It was about 13 months later that we first learned that the application for 206,000 new men in Vietnam had been turned down. And then a story was leaked and it came out, and I quote from the New York Times, 13 months later, after the request, "If tolerance of the war had won thin, so had the nation's military resources. So thin, indeed, that there was almost nothing more to send to Vietnam without either mobilizing the reserves, enlarging draft calls, lengthening the 12-month combat tour, or sending Vietnam veterans back for a second tour of duty. All extremely unappealing." We weren't short of manpower. We were short of manpower that supported the war, or families of manpower that supported the war. Well, then, from the Pentagon Papers, there's a whole lot there. But here, the massive anti-war demonstration organized in Washington on October 21st would, of necessity, have a restraining influence on the government's ability to carry out its policies, meaning its war. McNaughton, quote, was, from another paper, quote, "concerned that escalation of the land war beyond South Vietnam might lead to massive civil disobedience, particularly in view of opposition to the war among young people, the underprivileged, the intelligentsia, and women." Earlier, in a somewhat different context, because the siege of the Pentagon, like the war, didn't come in isolation, came as a series after a series of things. And earlier, Tom Wick had written in the Times, "If the Johnson administration had to prosecute 100,000 Americans in order to maintain its authority, its real power to pursue the Vietnamese war or any other policy would be crippled, if not destroyed. It would then be faced not with dissent, but with civil disobedience on a scale amounting to revolt." And it was that specter that had such a powerful restraining influence in the government. I almost hate to say powerful restraining influence, because it went on so long after that, and so many people, Vietnamese and Americans, were killed because of it. Well, just to conclude this section, I want to read a few sentences from Nicholas von Hoffman. He says, "In truth, Nixon was forced out of Vietnam because he had nothing left to fight with. The war slid out from under him as it once slid down on top of us. The army had quit on him a couple of years ago. He claims he pulled 500,000 troops out as if he had a choice. Next came the fleet, sabotage, race riots, and desertions. The last to crack was the Air Force. It finally got to them, and they started cashing in their pilots' wings. The marchers, the protesters, that rabble, they're the ones who served honorably. It'll be a long time before you hear anyone in the White House say that. They will continue to repeat that the movement had no effect on them, that while the peaceniks marched, they were watching the Washington Redskins. But don't you believe it, they were peeking through the curtains."
This is California Public Radio.